Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, The Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Tuesday, April 23rd, Joe was out of the office and I filled in as host, and I was joined by Ulster County Comptroller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, Marge Gallagher, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and The Empire Report's J.P. Miller. Former President Trump is back in court this morning for the second day after jury selection, the second day of testimony, and we'll do some kind of bullet points of what has happened and what is happening, and then we will talk about it. Trump's attorney used his opening statements to attack the case as baseless yesterday, saying the former president did nothing illegal. This is from the AP. The attorney, Todd Blanche, challenged prosecutors' claims that Trump agreed to pay Daniels to aid his campaign, saying Trump was trying to protect his family, his reputation, and his brand. The attorney indicated the defense will argue that after all, the very point of a presidential campaign is to try to influence the election. It's called democracy, Blanche told jurors. They put something sinister on this idea as if it were a crime. You will learn that it's not. Blanche also portrayed the ledger entries at issue in the case as pro forma actions performed by a Trump employee. Former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker is the first witness for the prosecutors, who say that Trump's alleged scheme to conceal potentially damaging information from voters began with a 2015 Trump Tower meeting among the then candidate Pecker and Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen. Pecker's brief turn on the stand Monday was mainly just about his background and other basic facts. He did say the Enquirer practiced checkbook journalism, paying for stories, and that he had the final say on any story about a famous person. He takes the stand again today, or is scheduled to, I should say. Two journalists covering the trial were removed and expelled for breaking rules prohibiting recording and photography in the overflow room. Just another point to add to the conversation. And the presumptive GOP nominee, that of course is former President Donald Trump, will be meeting with former Japanese Prime Minister Taro Aso after court today at Trump Tower. That's according to two people familiar with plans who spoke on condition of anonymity because they had not been formally announced. Several foreign leaders have met with Trump in recent weeks as U.S. allies prepare for the possibility that he could retake the White House. And we have a live update from a few minutes ago from the New York Times saying that prosecutors in Donald J. Trump's criminal trial say he has violated a gag order barring him from attacking witnesses and others close to the case, which centers, we know what the case centers on. So the judge is considering holding Trump in contempt of court for verbal attacks. Who would like to begin?
I will. I read that the penalty for each of those violations on the contempt order would be a $1,000 fine, which doesn't sound very much, and also that the judge may not weigh in today. You know, he may just hear arguments and then come back with an opinion later. I also thought it was interesting, this judge was the judge in an earlier criminal case with Trump on the Trump Organization and the nonprofit foundation side. And I didn't realize it was the same judge. I would assume, you know, Donald Trump has a lot of animosity towards this fellow now. And I had to go and look up Clinton's quote unquote, you know, settlement with Paula Jones, because I'm seeing a lot of chatter, particularly in, you know, conservative circles that, you know, Clinton played hush money too. But hush money is to keep people quiet, and Clinton's case was a settlement of an adjudicated, you know, a court case where the facts were out and were made public. It is not a crime to settle a case or to make a payment. That's not what this case is about, and I think that's the way it's portrayed. This case is really about falsification of business records. And before we get into having people say, well, that's not a big deal, the bottom line is sometimes you're going to be convicted of something that seems like it shouldn't be a big deal. Al Capone was taken down for tax evasion. Was that his biggest crime? No, probably not. So we're all watching, you know, this unfold. And we were joking on the break that Trump is probably jealous about the protests uptown because he's not seeing that outside the courthouse. Yeah.
Jay?
The biggest demonstrations ever. The Clinton thing is a really good point that, you know, in the court of public opinion, we don't like nuance and nuance is, you know, this is about nuance. The different and all these cases are, in a sense, that people want to say, well, Biden took home national security documents and Trump took home national security documents. So why aren't you prosecuting Biden, or why are you prosecuting Trump? And you know, Clinton did this, and Hillary did that, and Obama did that. You know, you can go on and on forever. I think that, you know, just listening to the opening arguments and then reading some of the very thoughtful pieces from legal experts who disagree with this trial, it's really interesting what the and it's kind of the nail biter of this for me is whether or not the prosecutors are really going to be able to draw a clear line for the jury to say that's the first thing. To explain to them, this is why, in this case, it was a bad thing. This is more than distasteful. This is more than business as usual in politics. It is this is illegal, and this is why it needs to be punished. I think they have to explain to them. It's not just the law. It's here's why it matters to you.
It's a tenuous argument they're making. It really is, because what they're saying is you falsified business records, and as an element of that claim, right, they're saying, and that was misleading the public on your presidential race.
Right.
And so, you know, there's that extra step. It's, I think it's tenuous to make the argument.
The other half of that is that he's not charged with the crimes that underlie the felonies. And that gets, you know, if you followed, you know, the Joe Bruno case was a good example of that, where it got to the Supreme Court and they said, wait a minute, this honest services business, which is not what this is, but I think it could get tied up in the same kind of argument where they say you needed to prove the other crime too, and you needed to do that. Why didn't you charge him exactly? And they'll say, well, it's not a state crime; it's a federal crime. You know, maybe that's going to hold some weight. This gets complicated.
We're going to see appeals.
Yeah,
definitely.
I think we're going to see appeals, and I think we're going to see the public say, what's the big deal? A lot of people, you know, are probably going to say that. And then the question is, what do the jurors end up saying? Yeah.
JP?
Yeah, you can see why Cy Vance decided not to bring this case when he was the district attorney. And I think that Alvin Bragg in the beginning didn't want to bring it, but may have felt pressured to bring it, and that he might face a Democratic primary if he didn't bring any charges against the former president.
He is in court again today. Not expected to attend every day, but is there again today.
And what I agree with what March and Jay said. It is an interesting case in that the facts of the dispute are not really in dispute. It's going to be a question of intent, and Trump's defense is going to be, well, I'm a big businessman. I write checks to people all the time, and it's my staffer's job to figure out how things should be allocated and how things should be done, and. You know, what will be interesting is I think the David Pecker testimony yesterday was basically introduction and background, basically establishing him as a credible witness, where today we will find out what exactly were his conversations with the former president. What did he talk about? Should this be a campaign expense or a personal business expense? How are we going to do this? What was Trump's intent when making this payment? How much did he mention the campaign? And I imagine that they wouldn't bring him up for testimony if he didn't have compelling testimony to give. So it'll be interesting to see exactly what he says today.
I think Michael Cohen's testimony is going to be the linchpin to this case. You know, Pecker, I think, is going to be, you know, the David Pecker and the National Enquirer, the catch and kill was really about a models, not Stormy Daniels, and about a separate doorman at a building who had an ostensible story that implicated Trump that I think was found to be totally irrelevant or not true. So it's really Cohen's testimony on the Stormy Daniels situation and what Trump's intention was that I think will drive this case. And hopefully the prosecution feels like they have a real case there. I think we'll be finding out. People have noted that he doesn't have a lot of support in the courtroom. You know, family isn't there. That's kind of unusual. Although, you know, he has so many court cases right now. I mean, if I were his family, I'd be like, dude, you're on your own. I mean, I can see that they're just
divide and conquer.
Yeah. Or maybe just like, we're not going to these, because if we go to one, then it makes a statement about all of them. I think that's a concern. And I was reading some polling on Newsmax. Please don't judge me for that. but a Rasmussen poll that was saying that, you know, 51% of the people polled said Trump cannot get a fair trial in New York. And I think if there's a conviction here, there's going to be a sentiment that Trump wasn't treated fairly, unfortunately, no matter how well orchestrated and how appropriate the rulings are from the bench. So that's a concern.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. The focus this morning in court does seem to be on the gag order, the prosecution presenting examples from Truth Social posts for reasons that Trump needs to be held in contempt. What do you guys think? Do you think it'll happen?
I mean,
I know it's so, just guess.
I get the sense, yes. The judge has little patience for his antics. I think somebody mentioned to me that he took out his cell phone in court at one point, and the judge said something to the lawyers like, tell your client to put that away, you know, that kind of thing. And I think the judge is very clear-headed about and maybe a bit, you know, antagonistic in the sense that I'm not going to let this guy walk all over me and make a mockery out of my courtroom. So he may have a bit of a legal chip, a judicial chip on his shoulder, as a lot of judges do. I mean, they just don't, you know, they don't tolerate nonsense well.
People who don't work in this field, though, I think don't understand why we have these rules in the courtroom. And that's confusing, I think, to people who haven't served on a trial or been involved in a criminal case themselves. Like, why can't he talk? You know, even the words gag order, I think, are really have a negative connotation. Trump is being chastened. He's not being allowed to talk. How is that a good thing? You know, he should have freedom of speech. So that is an issue right now, just the way it's perceived by regular people and certainly by his supporters. I think the judge's daughter was one of the people that Trump tweets on Truth Social. It's,
we don't know.
What is it?
Posts
on Truth Social.
I'm not sure.
But yeah, the why have a gag order and what does that mean? And what is the benefit to the rule of law, especially when you have a big contingent of Trump supporters who want to throw out the rule of law, right? We have these rules for a reason. It's so that we reach better judicial outcomes, fairer outcomes, more appropriate outcomes. But we have a bunch of people who don't care about that.
Right. Jonah Brumwich wrote in the Times 7 minutes ago, Conroy, the attorney, is reminding Justice Merchan of the procedural history here, notes that a second order came after Trump ratcheted up attacks on family members that, in personal language, hides something that the judge does know well. Those attacks were made on his own family members, including his daughter.
Scary. I mean, we had another, didn't we have a federal judge, I think Pennsylvania, or whose son was killed a couple of years ago? Yeah. And so, I mean, I think judges' families are at risk in situations like this, not necessarily from the defendant, but from supporters of the defendant and from people, you know, who are angry in the public. So it is, you know, the rules are there for a reason, not just to play a game with Trump.
And that may be one of the few things that, you know, jurists, no matter what their thoughts about this case or anything all around the country, probably agree on, is that they're looking to this judge to make it clear that you can't intimidate them. You can't stir up a mob against a court and expect to just get away with it. And that's what it's about. It's not about free speech.
Right.
Or it's about the limits of free speech, I guess.
One of the things that I think is on trial here is really going to be Trump's demeanor. How does he appear in the courtroom? You know, is that working to his benefit? And I think there's a lot of conversation going on about his appearance, his odor, his, you know, maybe falling asleep in one of the sessions. And it's going to be important, I think, to voters how he handles himself in the courtroom and whether he has outbursts or not or violates the rules or not. There are going to be those core supporters who don't care and just want to support him no matter what. And there are going to be people who are offended by his disrespect for the judicial system. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out and whether or not public opinion turns. I mean, I've seen some recent polling that had Biden up, and I think part of it is because of the behaviors and the outbursts that he's having. So this trial could really push the limit, especially given his prior history with this judge.
JP?
I think he's focused I think he, of course, wants to win this case, but I think that what his real focus is right now is winning the White House. And when you are in the press and you ask a politician a question about your court case, and the politician says, well, I've been advised by my lawyers not to talk about that topic, that sounds very guilty of the politician. That makes the politician seen in a poor light for a voter. Whereas if Trump is asked and he goes on the attack against the judge and he goes on the attack against it, you wouldn't believe what the judge's daughter said about me. He sees that as helping him with swing voters. He's got, you know, 90% of the country, basically their votes are settled. There are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% of the country that are vacillating or going in between Trump and Biden and trying to figure out who to vote for, and he is trying to look like he is the victim in those people's eyes, and that he's not the bad guy. He is the victim, and that was his playbook in 2016, 2020 as president of the United States. He was a victim, and this time in 2024, he's going to play the victim as well, and that's his playbook.
It's been working for him.
It was reported this morning that as he entered the courtroom, he did speak to media, but mostly about topics pertinent to the election and not the trial itself. We have letters from listeners who wrote into panel at WAMC.org, and I will begin with this one from Marie, who says, can Donald Trump's efforts to stir up protests around this election interference trial be used as evidence against him in the DOJ prosecution regarding January 6th?
No.
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 No, he's not. I don't think you could charge. I don't think you could bring in something that happens after the crime to somehow enhance the charges in a three-year-old.
A different case, right.
Four-year-old case.
John writes in and says, Trump says he should not be held in contempt of court because he is entitled to free speech. In fact, he wants his speech to be the only speech. He demonstrated that when he was in the White House, not allowing reporters in on conferences and the news coming only from his mouth. And let's see. Joan says, the whole U.S. population understands how respect in the court system works. The endless TV courtroom procedural shows like Law and Order have made that pretty clear. I think that's an interesting point because there are certainly citizens who don't understand the seriousness of the court or don't respect it or don't think it should be so serious because they feel completely victimized by the justice system. So I think there's, you know, factions, as with everything else. Mm-hmm. Jeff writes in and says, it's generally acknowledged that the election will come down to a small group of swing voters. Those who love Trump will not change their minds, nor will those who hate Trump. But regardless of whether you think Trump is the preferable candidate for a swing voter, who wants to sign up for 4 more years of constant turmoil and trouble? This chaos follows him around like Pigpen's dust cloud. It's a Peanuts cartoon reference. Republicans get bent out of shape when Biden fumbles a word or Obama wore a tan suit, but Trump chaos seriously damages the psyche of the nation. And that is from Jeff. And you also, Jay, wanted to talk about demonstrations.
Yeah, just briefly. I joke about it, but I think there's a serious aspect to the fact that not a lot of people are showing up for these demonstrations. You know, Trump had hoped, and I think he voiced that hope publicly, and certainly on Truth Social, that he would that people would show up for these and peacefully demonstrate. He stressed that this time, and I posted yesterday on Facebook that he was suggesting that this was a plot. The reason people couldn't get in, that somehow they were being kept out of New York by the security or being kept away from the courthouse by security. There is a demonstration zone, I believe, where people can come and they can demonstrate. I said I think the more plausible reason is that a lot of people looked at the last time they showed up for a Trump demonstration and said, I'm not going to participate in this. I do wonder if that's the case. And if it is, if we don't see any demonstrations of significance at the courthouse through the trial, I wonder what it says about the real support that Donald Trump has, whether it's support from a distance or it's as personal as so many people took it when they showed up on January 6th.
If they're starting in New York City.
Yeah, that's true.
So if the court, but if the York trial City's were like, somewhere else.
If you can't get a demonstration going in New York City.
Sure.
So you're thinking that the January 6th convictions are actually having a deterrence effect?
either the convictions or the association with the more whatever the word you want to use, the more extreme folks who showed up for the people just don't want to be associated with
that. Makes
with
me
that.
Happy, Jay.
That's
Thank
a, that, no, that's a good thing. I would,
if
I would
he's
be,
right.
I'd be encouraged by that. But it would also suggest that maybe mainstream Republicans are starting to say, I don't want to get involved in the craziness.
I mean,
maybe.
Deterrence is a theory of criminal justice, right? We have these laws and we have punishment for the purpose of deterring others from doing the same thing. So if deterrence is working here to have avoid lawless protests, which that was on January 6th, that would be a great thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows if people are going to show up or not? I think it depends on the twists and turns of the case and how the press goes and how Trump handles himself in the courtroom and outside. And I don't doubt that, you know, he could turn on a dime and you could see a lot more receptivity in the Trump community, the Trump supporters community, and you could see protests.
Yep.
So it could happen.
And you could see very noisy protests at the end when the jury is deliberating, especially that they, you know, let the jury hear you out on the street sort of protests. Who knows? We'll see.
Jay Jochnowitz on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, April 23rd. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. Joe Donahue was out of the office on Thursday, April 25th, and I filled in again as host. I was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, and Preceptor in Public Speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. Let us begin now discussing the protests on college campuses. This from the New York Times. A wave of pro-Palestinian protests spread and intensified on Wednesday as students gathered on campuses around the country, in some cases facing off with the police in a widening shutdown over campus speech and the war in Israel and Gaza. University administrators from Texas to California moved to clear protesters and prevent encampments from taking hold on their own campuses, as they have at Columbia University, deploying police in tense new confrontations that have already led to dozens of arrests. At the same time, new protests continued erupting in places like Pittsburgh and San Antonio. Students expressed solidarity with their fellow students at Columbia and with a movement that appeared to be galvanized by the pushback on other campuses and the looming end of the academic year. Protesters on several campuses said their demands included divestment by their universities from companies connected to the Israeli military campaign in Gaza, disclosure of those and other investments, and a recognition of the continuing right to protest without punishment. You can join the conversation by emailing panel at WAMC.org. And for this one, I will begin with Malia, please.
Oh, gee, thanks. well, I want to share an email I got this morning from the Harvard Club of New York City, where I'm a member. I think most of the listening audience knows I got my undergraduate degree at Bard, but I went to Harvard for my master's degree, and I've been a member of the Harvard Club for quite some time. It's my office away from the office when I'm in New York City. So, and I should, for full disclosure, say I used to work at Harvard, too, and I'm glad I don't anymore. So I got this email this morning, and you know, I'm grateful for the education I received at Harvard. I'm glad I was part of that community, but I've just over the past couple of years, really starting during COVID, when I thought the university did a terrible job managing that situation, and they just showed, and even more so now, how risk averse they are. And this email I got this morning from the Harvard Club sort of shows that. And so It's an invitation to attend a Zoom event on the future of Palestine. And this is how they describe the event and introduce it. We are treading cautiously into programming involving the Israel-Hamas war because it is contentious. And no matter what one says or feels, controversy follows. So we will address a question for which there is no implied judgment. What is Palestine going to look like a year from now or five? And they're bringing in a CIA veteran who has a lot of experience in the region to talk about that. So I looked at this email and I thought, first of all, like, it's taken this, you know, Harvard Club of New York City over 6 months to determine how they want to address this issue, which is, you know, one of the most important things in the world right now. It's galvanizing students on college campuses. It's affecting foreign policy in the Middle East, and arguably the most famous university in the world, in the greatest city in the world, decides that their priorities are avoiding contentiousness and controversy, and only asking questions for which there's no implied judgment. So I think this sort of points to the level of risk aversion that has led to a huge vacuum in intellectual leadership at a lot of universities around the country on these issues. They're not modeling the kind of behavior that helps people, including their own students, understand that you can talk about contentious issues and not have it devolve into horrible protests and arrests. It's obviously much harder on a huge urban campus, like where a lot of these protests are taking place. But there are places, there are many, many colleges and universities in this country where people are having important conversations and they are taking intellectual leadership. And unfortunately, you don't hear about those as much. So I worry about the all kinds of implications, including for people's trust in the value of higher education. I think the way university leaders have handled this, including the hearings in front of Congress, has caused a lot of people to doubt the intellectual leadership in this country.
The demonstrations have spread overseas as well, with students on campuses in Cairo, Paris, and Sydney, Australia, gathering to voice support for Palestinians in opposition to the war. As new protests were emerging, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, visited the Columbia campus in New York, where university officials were seeking to negotiate with protest leaders. The Speaker of the House has also called on President Biden to do something. Terry.
Well, I think that what was just said is very clear. And I agree with much of what was just said. I feel like we are at a time where higher education was already being challenged in a variety of ways in its ability to really adapt to the 21st century and modern technology and trying to provide pathways for a more equitable student body that actually looks like this country. And this now, with the Israel-Palestine-Gaza conflict, is really testing all of the leadership. Certainly here where I work at Harvard, we know that has occurred and continues to occur. There is a new encampment on Harvard Yard now by students, and it's going to be interesting to see how this current president deals with that. I have been a proponent of really trying to encourage my employer, Harvard, as well as other universities as well, to really reach out and try to bring in people that are not part of the higher education system, people that have experience in public relations, people that have experience in politics and political campaigns. So I think there is a real disconnect in how they are communicating with the public. Like, they have been taking way too much advice from lawyers and not nearly enough advice from people that understand how to speak with empathy, how to communicate as a human being, and how to really find ways to constructively enter into conversation with those who have opposing views and find some way to bring them together to try to find compromise. Instead, their language has all too often been part of what's created a division, because they can't quite figure out exactly how to address it, because I don't think they really have the training and the skills to do so. And we just kind of keep going around and around this vicious circle. And I am concerned about where we're headed with this. And I'm really concerned about how this is going to impact our upcoming presidential election. And I really would like to see Joe Biden be more vocal on this, be more transparent on it. I think it is between that and immigration, the two issues that could really potentially damage him. And of course, let's not forget the people in both Gaza and Israel that are being severely impacted by all of this. So this is a delicate time, to say the least.
Well, my frame of reference for this is being a student at New Paltz College in the late 60s, right up to 1970 when I graduated. And when I graduated, shortly before I graduated, the students at New Paltz protesting what had happened at Kent State only days before protested and took over the main building. The history of protest on college campuses is part of the fabric of our society, I believe. The whole concept of academic freedom, of students learning from their mistakes, hopefully. And I think the current protest is, as it's spread around the country, is a manifestation of the historical trend. What concerns me about the current protests is, and unless my memory is horrible, and it might be, I never felt threatened, or students who might not have agreed with what the protesters were protesting never felt physically threatened. And the nature of this dispute and the war in Gaza, it seems to me it's changed the rhetoric, and it's led to some of the hesitation that Malia and Terry just described on Harvard's campus. I'm surprised, frankly, that there haven't been more protests on more college campuses, New Paltz being one of them, Bard being another. Malia, I don't believe there's been anything going on at Bard. Tell me if I'm wrong. But again, I don't believe there's anything inherently wrong with these protests, except if they cross a line and threaten people. Threaten people's safety.
So first, just the mention of Kent State. I mean, I went to high school in Ohio. My mom retired from Kent State. And I just remember the first time we ever went there, when she started working there, the first thing we did, because she was a child of the 60s and protested Vietnam, is visit the memorial that's on that campus. That's sort of loomed large in my consciousness since I was fairly young. But to just respond to, two things. First, Ira's questions about, what's been happening at Bard. We do have a Students for Justice in Palestine chapter at Bard, like many, many colleges and universities do around the country. And we had a big event on campus recently. We had a big open house for all of our admitted students who are trying to decide if they're going to come to Bard. And the Students for Justice in Palestine, of course, they wanted to to take advantage of the fact they're going to be a huge audience on campus. So what did they do? They printed out some really nice pamphlets of about Palestine, and they stood around in various places on campus and asked all of our visitors, would you like to learn about Bard's connections to Palestine? And it turns out that Bard College is the only institution of higher education in America that has a dual degree program with a Palestinian university. We've been doing this for over 15 years. And so we have longstanding connections, like really substantial connections to people and institutions in Israel and Palestine. And so our students are aware of that. They're exposed to that. And we haven't, unlike the Harvard Club of New York City, haven't shied away from talking about these things. And we've, right after October 7th, we started holding all kinds of events with lots of different faculty and student groups. And so the modeling of the behavior, first of all, of that it's possible to talk about these things and not physically attack each other, has been really important on the life of our campus. But also the fact that Bard has been out in front on this particular issue, because it's true anywhere around the world. if there is severe inequity in access to higher education, and for educational institutions, so that's what, you know, what that's what we care about. When there's severe inequity in access, that has all kinds of terrible implications for people's lives, for democracy. And so we at BARD are interested in that. And that's how we got involved in Palestine in the first place over 15 years ago. Now, just very briefly to get to what Terry was saying before about, you know, these university presidents, you know, talking to lawyers and not being really empathetic. I mean, why are they defaulting? These are not stupid people at all. Why are they defaulting to such a risk-averse mentality? I think a lot of it comes back to the increasingly untenable financial structure of higher education in this country. And we as citizens are partly responsible for that because we have allowed our public, our elected officials to invest less and less in education. And that's partly one of the causes of this current crisis.
Terry?
Yeah, that's a great point. No, that's a great point. That had we been properly investing in public education, certainly at the higher education level across this country, the dynamic, I think, would be very different. You have a system, obviously, at Harvard and other Ivy League schools where they rely heavily on alumni and other donors that have a lot of leverage over how the university conducts itself. And that is going to inevitably lead to situations where the president and the administration is put into difficult decision-making processes that could alienate those financial gains, which they desperately need to keep offering what they offer. I will say Harvard is doing some things to try to address this. They are in the program, in the division that I work in, we are going to be piloting a new civil discourse class next semester, where students can sign up and really participate actively in class in learning how to discuss very controversial issues in a civil way. And if that pilot is successful, then the idea is to roll it out and make it a much wider offering for the entire campus. And I am involved in that to some degree, and I'm excited to see where that heads. But I think we're going to need more than that across this country to really bring civil discourse back to not only college campuses, but just to our local town halls and to our local council meetings and just to you know, our neighborhood backyards. We all kind of need to go back to communication 101 and remember how important it is to engage our fellow citizens in conversations, even if they are about things that we don't necessarily agree with, but that we can, and we do have a history of being able to do it in ways that allow us to find compromise, move forward, and to not completely damage, bring our entire country to a halt, which is what seems to be happening now.
Terry Gibson on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, April 25th. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break. Back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LeDuc. On Friday, April 26th, Joe Donahue was joined for the Roundtable panel by diplomat in residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, and executive director of the Alliance for a Hunger-Free New York and the Food Pantries for the Capital District, Natasha Pernicka.
The U.S. had the highest rate of people struggling to afford enough food to feed themselves and their families of all G7 countries in 2023, according to a Gallup survey. One in four, 26% Americans surveyed in the new analysis titled U.S. Leader or Loser, said there have been times in the past 12 months when they did not have enough money to buy the food they needed. In Canada, the rate of residents struggling to afford food with the same within the same time frame was 17%, while in France it went down to 15%, and Italy 14%. Some 13% of Germans were unable to afford food at times last year, against 9% in the UK and 8% in Japan. So what is going on in the United States of America? While the U.S. has consistently been at the top or tied at the top for inability to afford food at times every year since 2009, the new data shows that the number of struggling Americans is growing. Inability to afford food has never been higher in the United States since Gallup started tracking the measure in 2006. And the figure comes amid a backdrop of recent food price inflation in the United States, which increased sharply in 2022 and remained high last year. Those are world numbers. Those are national numbers. Meanwhile, we're seeing numbers increase in New York State as well. And we're also seeing a great effort put forward by legislators and activists to increase the amount of money to help those who are food insecure. However, that was spurned in the adoption of the latest budget, which was passed within the last week. Natasha, we don't Where do we start? Where do we find good news in this? This is all bad.
Okay, so the good news is that this terrible news is showing us that United States should recognize food as a human right. United States also does not recognize the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that food should be a right. So our policy reflects that. And it comes from a federal level and goes down to states. Our federal government, you know, we've got some anti-hunger programs from a federal level, looking at the Farm Bill. That's a major food system. But over the years, the manufactured food industry is the one that's really profiting off of federal government policy. We have seen that with recently the manufactured food industry, which is big food, which is most of the food we eat, has been making record billions in profit while consumers can't afford to eat. Since the New York State budget was passed over the past couple years here in New York, we've seen a 9.1% increase in the cost of food. And it's not regular people are not being able to keep up with this. So if you look at it from a federal perspective, you know, we're investing in a very expensive and not nutritious food system. When you take it down to the state level, New York State actually is a leader in investing in programs trying to bring healthy food down to those who are economically disadvantaged. However, extremely disappointed in this governor's administrative team. We yet again have basically stagnant funding in the important programs that help support our charitable feeding system. I've been saying this for a couple years, Joe. You know that I feel like I'm like the running around the sky is falling. I've been doing this because we've been seeing record numbers in food pantries across the state for the past 2 years, and each year it keeps getting worse. So there's absolutely no justification for a stagnant budget here in New York State.
Your proposal was what? To raise it by what?
So the two major programs, HPNAP and Nourish New York, they're currently, well, they were a little bit over $100 million. That's like crumbs in our $237 billion budget. We were asking them to increase it to $150 million, and it's pretty flat funded.
So where does the disconnect come in? Because there seemed to be a movement when we talked with you during the fund drive in February. It seemed like there was movement, there was legislative action, there were legislators who were taking this up. there was bipartisanship on this issue. And I'm just curious, of given how it affects so many people, of how it somehow got forgotten.
I really appreciate that. And we need to get to the bottom of this. I think we did have support in both Senate and Assembly for increasing the dollar amounts in the budget. We had other legislators asking to increase SNAP benefits, which, for anyone who knows, SNAP benefits used to provide about 75% of a family's resources needed for food. At this point, we have people getting $28 a month in SNAP assistance. That's not even supplemental. That's like one meal for your entire month. So I think I'm going to have to say, one of the areas we don't have an active voice is in the governor's office. We do not have anyone representing nutrition security, hunger relief at a governor level in chamber. And I think that it gets lost because we don't have a champion. I'm extremely disappointed. I mean, we were working with, folks coming from, human services, health, agriculture. Like, those are the closest things we have to saying, like, health, agriculture, and human services. Those are the people that should be caring that people have enough healthy food to eat. And it wasn't enough. We provided stories and statistics showing the dramatic increases in need for food pantry assistance. Regular people, I say regular, everybody's a regular person. But I think when you think of who's hungry, a lot of people still have this very inaccurate view that it's a person out on the street begging for change. And that is absolutely not the case. It is people who are working. It is older adults who are retired on extremely limited incomes. It's, single income families. It's just regular people who are not making ends meet.
Let me ask about, because one of the major aspects of this budget was housing, which, I mean, that comes into this too, right? Housing comes into it. Homelessness comes into it. There's so many overlapping issues. And to look at one and not the other and not to look at it holistically seems to be, seems to be foolish, but also doesn't seem to just make sense.
Well, in the governor's State of the State this year, she did talk a lot about housing, older adults, children, education, and food. Having access to healthy food is at the basis for all of her priorities in the State of the State. If adults don't have enough food to eat, they're not going to be able to be productive at work. If children don't have enough food to eat, they're not going to be able to learn. And if older adults don't have enough to eat, their health is going to be greatly impacted. So the fact that there was literally not an increase in supporting food at a time of increased need and rising inflation in food it's just catastrophic, honestly, for the millions of New Yorkers who are struggling right now.
You know, Natasha, you mentioned that you're unable to locate an advocate for this issue in the governor's office. It just strikes me, given the nature of the problem, the advocate ought to be the governor herself.
I would love for Governor Hochul to hear that right now. Yeah. I mean, it's true. It's just atrocious, honestly.
I have a question for you. During the pandemic, there were special programs. There was additional funding addressing this problem. Those special programs have expired. And I'm just curious, based on what you saw during the pandemic, what was the effect of these programs, and should they be resurrected, pandemic or no?
The pandemic programs made a big difference. It was the first time that we had seen child poverty numbers decrease. People did not have to turn to food pantries. We actually saw a decrease in food pantry assistance numbers, which we have never seen a decrease. I've been doing this work for over a decade. I have pantry coordinators who have been doing it for many decades. When federal government took action and gave people money to put in their own pockets, they were able to go to the grocery store and buy food for their families. Imagine that. Wow. So child tax credits made a big difference. SNAP made a big difference. SNAP is actually arguably one of the best anti-hunger programs we have because it gives people the chance to go to a grocery store like anybody else. They don't have to go to the pantry where they might feel stigma. And they can make a personal choice about what their family is used to eating instead of relying on a very limited supply chain that the food pantries have to deal with. So, yeah. And now when the pandemic EBT SNAP benefits decreased, we are seeing people turn to food pantries who have never had to turn to food pantries before because the SNAP assistance, like I mentioned, it used to be enough value to last on average 3 out of the 4 weeks. So the trend used to be the last week of the month, you would see a spike in people coming to food pantries because they had run out of SNAP. That is absolutely not the case. Now we have people going even weekly to pantries because SNAP benefits aren't even close to covering food costs.
And I take it the programs that that had this positive impact during the pandemic were principally federal?
Federal funding going down to the state levels. Okay. And here in New York State, we did have actually a new program that was incredibly successful. The Nourish New York program was launched during 2020, which was the state here in New York taking action, where food banks and food pantries were able to purchase agriculture, fruits and vegetables, dairy, meats from New York State producers. Because remember, the supply chain really changed when institutions were closed and restaurants were closed. So you had all of these New York State producers who didn't have anywhere. And it was a wonderful win-win solution that the state came up with to say, okay, we'll invest in people who need the food the most and help keep our New York State producers active. So the state is continuing to fund it, but they're not increasing the dollar amount. And everyone is seeing their costs increase, even New York State farmers. So it's really a loss of opportunity to not advance this program further.
Jim? We were talking before about people being in touch with their representatives and holding them accountable. You know, this is a year where we have a presidential election. We have every member of the House of Representatives up for election. We have every member of the New York State Legislature up for election. Candidates, members are out and about meeting with the public. And given the enormity of this problem, people, whether they're suffering from the problem or they're seeing society suffer from the problem, even if they're in a good enough situation themselves, they ought to be saying to these people running for these offices, this is a huge problem. This report just came out that highlights the problem. What are you specifically going to do about this? Don't give me a talking point. Don't just give me platitudes. What specifically will you do about this? And if they don't give a good answer, then you ought to rethink who you vote for. And you ought to not let the politicians give a vague answer. I think these are the sorts of things that have to be done specifically. You know, this is shaping up to be a year that feels very much like 1968. And in the latter part of his life, Martin Luther King Jr. was focusing on poverty. And Robert Kennedy Sr. was focused on poverty. Unfortunately, in 1968, we lost both of them. I don't hear this being part of the presidential campaign so far. I don't hear it being part of the national conversation or on the state level. And I think the only way that's going to change is if people hold representatives accountable.
Natasha, we've been talking a little bit about SNAP. Can you explain? I know you've done this. You've explained this to me way too many times. But how SNAP benefits are both state and federally funded. So how does that work and how does one impact the other?
So the federal government has like the basic SNAP that comes down, but states can supplement it with their own resources. So here in New York, we're not supplementing the federal SNAP benefits. So that means people are really at a bare minimum. But there was some legislative action to try to increase the SNAP benefit here in New York with the state supplementing the benefit level. That wasn't successful this year, but we'll keep pushing on that. The SNAP funding here in New York State is really about outreach. to get people to sign up for SNAP benefits. So the state invests money in helping people learn about SNAP benefits and encouraging them to sign up for it.
When you look at the pantries of the food pantries of the Capital District, what is the what are the numbers? What's the increase that you see just in what 60? What are you up to 70?
Just locally, there's about 70,000 people here in Albany, Rensselaer, Saratoga, and Schenectady counties. 70,000 people who utilize food pantries every year. It's significantly more than that. There's a pantry down in New York City that serves 70,000, just that one pantry, and it's one of the smaller pantries in New York City. We've seen service levels increase anywhere from 20 to literally 600% since pre-pandemic across the state. On average, it's about a 30% increase in service levels. There's a lot of people turning to food pantries right now.
So if the food isn't there, what do they do?
So unfortunately, this is what happens. So, decades ago, it was the emergency feeding system was really a get what you get. It relied very heavily on the federal USDA commodity, like TANF. You think of like the government cheese and the canned chicken and canned vegetables and fruit. That was largely what was being distributed, 20 years ago. But what's happened is that this really isn't an emergency food system. It really is a supplemental feeding system for many people on a regular basis. And you can't adequately live off of, a lot of high sodium canned foods. It's not healthy. And over the years, once we recognized that this really is a supplemental food system for many people, there was a real push to get healthier food into the food pantry system. So it also goes along with dignity. And I share this story a lot about my own grandparents. My grandpa was a union carpenter. And by the time he was a lot older, they had a very limited income. And my grandma didn't know what to do with a lot of the food that she was getting. She wasn't used to eating it, just that government food. So pantries in communities are trying to be responsive and treat people with as much dignity as they can by providing different types of food that people are used to eating, whatever their cultural or family heritage is, because this isn't a failure of a human. This is a systemic issue, and people need to be treated with dignity.
I want to just touch in on what you said about an emergency food system. I mean, we're in emergency, but we're not labeling it as such, even though it is.
This is literally a crisis. If you have 25% of your population not having enough resources for healthy food, and that was the national stat in the article that you read earlier. New York State Department of Health did their own survey, which again, 25% of adults have experienced food insecurity in the last year. Like this is something that is way beyond a charitable solution. This demands federal and state action to make sure that the population has healthy food. We can't sustain ourselves on high sodium, processed, manufactured food. Yes, you won't die, but then that creates a whole other problem of health impacts.
What are other countries in that article that I read from Pew and as well as from it was from Newsweek? What are other countries doing that keep their numbers almost half of what ours are?
If you look at the manufactured food industries in other countries, I think part of it is their local food systems. Like other places focus a lot more on local food system development. Their restrictions on chemicals and additives in foods are a lot more stringent. So the food that people are getting is healthier. And another piece to that is that if a person is eating healthier food, they're going to be more satisfied. If people have a consistently unhealthy diet because they don't have access to healthy food, they're going to continue to be hungry because their body doesn't have the nutrition that it's needing. So it's starting to crave additional food, not to mention the addictive chemicals. So other countries have a lot more stringent rules on the manufactured food industry, as well as more investment in local food systems.
Natasha Pernicka on the Roundtable panel on Friday, April 26th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org via podcast or in the WAMC app. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.